you can really see them, you know, starting to hit their stride as mm-hmm. filmmakers, and just yep. in the way that the story is told and the way that it's edited, yep. you know, the camera work, like you can see them, you know, starting to really mature into the filmmakers that, you know, will go on and just do whatever they want to do in whatever Absolutely. Genre, you know, and knock it out of the park.
Welcome to My Movie Story. I'm your host, Brian McAleer. This is the podcast where we dive into the movies that have shaped us. Each episode, we sit down with a special guest to discuss their all-time favorite film, the movie that changed their life, and the one film they think everyone needs to see. Get ready as we journey through the cinematic worlds that make us who we are. This is My Movie Story. My guest for this episode is Rob Mabry. Rob is an accomplished filmmaker hailing from Austin, Texas. His passion for movies runs deep, both as an avid audience member and a dedicated filmmaker. Film has always been a powerful means of connection for Rob, a love that took root in his early years and continues to shape who he is today. Rob recently premiered his feature film, The Legend of El Chupacabra, an independent horror comedy which is available on Blu-ray and DVD, and you'll find out more about his film in this episode. Now, here's our interview with Rob. Well, hey, movie lovers, welcome to My Movie Story again, and welcome, Rob, to the podcast. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm doing great, Brian. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for joining us all the way from Texas, and you were just telling me it's getting pretty warm there. You're coming into summer at the time of this recording, and you'll probably laugh that here in Melbourne, it's like 2 or 3 degrees Celsius each morning at the moment, and foggy, and yeah, it's
brisk.
Hot, but, yeah, you're enjoying your summer, and we're freezing to death over here, but it's fine. But yeah, great. Well, great to have you here on the podcast, and you know, we've got a few different films to talk about, and I guess the main thing that people are going to notice who are watching this video is there's awesome posters in the background, and you're a filmmaker. So yeah, tell us a bit about that, Rob. What's that all about?
Yeah, I just wrapped my first feature film. It's called The Legend of El Chupacabra. It's actually available on DVD and Blu-ray, and hopefully in the coming weeks or potentially months, it will make its way onto streaming platforms. It's been a bit of a laborious process to make that happen. So I'm waiting on that. But I have been a writer all my life. I was, you know, the type of kid who, you know, drew comic books in his bedroom, and I wrote plays, and forced my friends, you know, to act and perform the things that I had written. So I've always had a passion for writing and a love of film. You know, my big dream was to be a Hollywood screenwriter. Yep. You know, I thought that I would run off to Hollywood and, you know, make it big in the film business as a writer. Ended up having a family instead, and it kind of put my dreams of, you know, filmmaking on hold. I'd say it was about 7 years ago, the, you know, dream kind of came back, and I realized that the technology had kind of democratized filmmaking. And, you know, if you could make a movie, you know, with a prosumer type camera. So I started doing short films, and I probably made 20 short films.
Wow.
And worked my way up, you know, learned the craft, and finally felt like I was ready in 2021. I made the decision to make a feature film, and of course, you know, you have to write the script, there's pre-production, filming, and then post-production. In October of 2023, had our premiere of the film. Just had another premiere in Austin, Texas. The first premiere was in San Antonio, which is my hometown. So we had another premiere in Austin a few weeks ago, and then the DVD and Blu-ray release. And so it's been a really, really exciting process.
Fantastic. Yeah. And what a journey, you know, and good on you for like not letting go of that and, you know, continuing with that passion. And it's hard, definitely, when you start a family and you've got a job and a household to run and all those other things that come with it, right? But, you know, there's always a way. When there's a will, there's a way, you know. So it's definitely, you know, seeing that you've achieved that's definitely kind of reignited my
passions as well. Like when I was younger, I was dabbling in script writing, and I was going to make a short film, and kind of went off in a different direction. But that idea is always there. It's always kind of the ideas that keep bugging you, I think, are the ones you've got to pay attention to and do something with it, right? Otherwise, you'll just regret it if you don't. Yeah.
I tell people it's never too late to make your first movie. And also you can't make a good movie until you make a bad movie. So
Yep. Awesome.
get out there and just do it. Don't let
Have a go.
excuses stand in your way. Have a go.
Exactly.
There you
Have a
go.
go. That's right. Yeah, and just quickly, we'll definitely share the links to your film, but can you quickly just tell us what it's about, and just so people get an idea of the film itself?
Yeah, Legend of El Chupacabra is a sci-fi horror comedy. It is heavily weighted to the comedy because that's really my passion and what I love. It's a story about a group of kids, the Chupacabra Club. Two boys and a girl, have an encounter with the Chupacabra when they're little kids, and one of the boys, sort of a nerdy kid, never really lets go of that experience. And he lives in this little sleepy town in the hill country of Texas, and he has devoted his life to tracking the Chupacabra. And every four years there are these disappearances and killings in this town. When it happens again, he has to kind of bring the Chupacabra Club back together as adults, and of course they have zero interest in his little mission.
Sure.
But he's determined, and they swore a blood oath. So he holds them to this blood oath to track down the Chupacabra and save the town. So
Awesome.
that is it in a nutshell.
Yeah, definitely. And I watched the film, and it was fun. It was funny. The creature design is really inventive, and quite intimidating, actually. That creature. So yeah, and our viewers can see the mask there in the background. So it's a good ride. It's good fun, and hopefully we'll see that on some streaming platforms here in Australia, and we'll definitely help you reach some Aussie horror fans, because there's definitely plenty of us down under who will watch that stuff, including me. So yeah, congratulations on the film, and yeah, hopefully we'll see more films in the future. Have you any other kind of ideas in the works, or anything else coming up?
I've got really two scripts that I'm polishing right now. One is a mockumentary horror comedy. I'm a big fan of the mockumentary format. Like
Yep.
Spinal Tap is a movie I
Of
probably
course.
should have picked as one I would want to talk about because it's one of my favorite movies
Hilarious.
of all time. And then of course, The Office. I'm a huge fan of that show. And so I feel like I've got a unique take on kind of a horror mockumentary that I don't want to spill too much about. But the other project that I have is a sequel of sorts to the Chupacabra.
Oh, yeah.
It's set in the same town, this fictional town of Bluffton, Texas. And what I plan to do is bring sort of the same cast back together in a completely different story about an alien invasion that happens in this town. But it would have a very similar tone, comedic tone, to Chupacabra. And so I guess Bluffton is kind of like, Stephen King has Derry, right? The town where he sets a lot of his stories,
That's
and
right. Yeah.
Bluffton is my Derry.
That's
So
your Derek.
I
Fantastic.
hope to make three films in that setting. So
Fantastic. Excellent.
yeah, wish me
Excellent.
luck. It's
Yes, we
not cheap to
do.
make a movie.
Yeah.
That's why I have two ideas, because the horror mockumentary is a much more affordable project than the alien invasion story, which probably is going to require a bit more of a budget. So I may
Right.
make that mockumentary first, and then get to the sequel a little later. At least that's
Cool.
the plan now.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, we will watch this space in anticipation, and yeah, definitely. And at the end of the episode, we might get you just to tell people where they can connect with you and follow your work as well.
Yeah, that'd be great.
So let's dive in, shall we, Rob? So we've got three films as usual on our podcast to talk about. Your all-time favorite, the film that changed your perspective on comedy in this case, and the film you think everyone should see. And after watching your film and then revisiting these films, I sort of maybe a little bit of inspiration you drew from these films. May I, that was my
Oh, it's in
interpretation.
there.
It's
in
in
there
there.
for
Yep,
sure.
great. Okay, I picked up on that. Yep. So yeah, I'm really keen to hear about, how you arrived with these films and how they've influenced you and how they've connected with you. So we'll start with your all-time favorite. And all I can say so far is this is a part of a saga. We've already featured one of those films on this podcast, so it's great that we're kind of working our way through the rest of the series. So yes, please tell us, Rob, what is this all-time favorite movie of yours?
My all-time favorite movie is Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Fantastic.
We have no time if you still want the Ark. It has been loaded onto a truck for Cairo.
Raiders of the Lost Ark. A film from Steven Spielberg and George Lucas.
The original the original Indiana Jones,
Yes,
which was
it's
originally
not in
just
my
called
mind,
Raiders of the Lost Ark, wasn't it?
it's
Yeah.
not Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark.
No,
It
no.
is Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Just Raiders of the Lost Ark. Yeah. And then they changed it to Indiana Jones. And I'm guessing if you can get an original DVD or video that just says Raiders of the Lost Ark, it's probably be worth a bit of money now. Things like that become
I hadn't
collectibles.
thought of that.
Yeah.
Yes, the
Could be.
titles in the film still just say Raiders of the Lost Ark.
That's it, which tells you everything you need to know really about this film. So obviously most people watching and listening to this know who Indiana Jones is, but just in case we're talking to someone who's maybe come out of a 40-year coma or has never seen the film, take us back to the original Indiana Jones tale. How do we meet him, and what's his story?
Yeah, so Indiana Jones is an archaeologist. The film takes place, I think, around 1939. He is sort of a swashbuckling adventurer. One of the things I love about the character is while he is a hero, he fails frequently in the film, right? He doesn't always get exactly what he needs the first time,
No.
but he inevitably perseveres. A really great hero character played by Harrison Ford. There's the movie takes a lot of inspiration from I think films in the 50s, the serials of the 30s and 40s. And for those who may not know what a serial is, back in the 30s and 40s, if you went to see a movie on a Sunday afternoon, a matinee, they would play a sort of 10-minute, short film. Usually an Adventure Zorro was one of the early and very popular serials, and I think was part of the inspiration for the character of Indiana Jones. But so those serials, was adventure stories. The sort of pulp comic books inspired these serials, and so that was a lot of the genesis of this character of Indiana Jones. And in the Raiders, sorry, in Raiders of the Lost Ark, he is in search of the Ark of the Covenant, which is a kind of spiritual and mystical object that the Nazis are after. And so he is, on a quest to recover the Ark of the Covenant, and so are the Nazis. And so he finds himself battling the Nazis and a French archaeologist by the name of Belloc, who is his nemesis,
That's right.
who always seems to get the upper hand. Every time Indiana Jones thinks that he has what he needs, Belloc seems to sweep in and take it away from him. So,
He's always there, isn't he? Yeah. He's kind of
yeah.
a pain. He's the thorn in his side, isn't he? Absolutely.
He's a great nemesis character for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, out of, I guess, all the villains across the films, I think I remember that villain the most, because he wasn't necessarily like an evil man. He was very passionate, like Indiana Jones, passionate about archaeology, passionate about finding, being the first to claim the prize. But obviously He wanted it for the glory and the fame and the fortune, whereas Indiana Jones was like, we need to get this artifact and get it to a museum where it belongs, right? So, to
Yes.
keep it out of the hands of these, you know, these filthy thieves and that sort of thing. So they were kind of polar opposites in a lot of ways, weren't they?
Yeah, for sure. Two sides of the same coin, I think. And you know, for whereas you know, Indiana Jones achieves his goals through you know grit and determination. I think the character of Belloc always seems to be cutting corners, and you know, of course, has the Nazi army you know sort of behind him, supporting him, and making it quite a bit easier, I guess, in that regard.
Definitely. And that's right. He is paired up with the Nazis, isn't it? Because they obviously want to take over the world and have possession of everything for power and whatever it is. And then, as we find later on in the film, it's too much power for anyone to control. And yeah, it doesn't end well for them. But yeah, let's go back to, I guess, the original, I guess, attraction to Indiana Jones for you. So the original film came out, I believe, 1981, I think it was.
Yeah,
So
summer
yeah.
of 81. Yeah, there's you know, as I thought about the film and kind of its influence on me, and why I'm so drawn to it, I think there's a couple of things. I actually grew up for at least a portion of my life in Germany, in a small town called Bad Aibling in Bavaria, on a what was a U.S. military base. But prior to that, it was actually a Nazi military base.
Okay.
And so, as kids, we had this legend that that there was Hitler's gold hidden somewhere on this base. And it was really interesting. Like, as kids, you know, we had the freedom to run amok on this military base, and we could actually get into the tunnels that existed,
Wow.
you know, from the Nazi era, and just traverse the base going through these tunnels.
Amazing.
So we would go on these adventures, you know,
Wow.
looking for Hitler's lost gold, you know, which I'm not sure who made that up. We never found any gold, but so I think there, you know, there was that sort of aspect of adventure, you know, from my childhood, and also a familiarity, you know, with Nazis as a young kid, that I think played into my appreciation for the film for sure. So that was a big part of it, and then, you know, on that base, every Sunday I would go to a Sunday matinee. My mom would give me a dollar, which was enough to get into the movie and get some popcorn and get some soda. You know,
The
this
good old
was
days,
close.
hey?
Yeah, well, it was close to 50 years ago, so I guess that dates me a bit. But I would actually see those serials that I was, you know, talking about it, that being inspiration for the Indiana Jones films, because they would play them before the movies in the matinee. And so I, you know, that was one of my favorite parts. And, you know, I'd go back every week to see what happened, you know, in Zorro's adventures. And so I think that was another thing that drew me to the film.
Wow. What a fascinating childhood. Just picturing what you described there, like being able to roam this old base and these tunnels, like that must have just been so much fun as a kid, you know, and
Well, you know, it makes you wonder what my parents were thinking, and you know, we always say like, oh, it was a different time, but it was
was, you
really
know.
a
And
different time. You
that's
know,
it
there was
was a
no cell
different
phone. It
time, you
was
know.
like, be home by 6. Okay, I'm gonna go, you know,
That's
have an
it.
adventure.
Yeah, and even
So.
myself, as you know, as a kid in the sort of early to mid 90s, it was very much the same thing. It was like we would just disappear for a day. There was no mobile phones. My mum would say, look, at this time, find a payphone and call me. Just let me know you're okay. And as I got older, that kind of wore off. But yeah, when we were young, she had no idea what we were up to. So if you're watching this, mum, you're about to find out. I was climbing up really tall trees and we would hang off the top branch, see how long we could hold on. And this was a good like 60, 70 feet off the ground.
Oh,
We'd
yeah.
go into old derelict buildings and ride our bikes through there. It was great. It was fantastic. And
Yeah.
I don't know if how kids these days can, you know, they don't know what they're missing out on, I think. But anyway, just a different time, wasn't it?
Oh, it absolutely was, yeah.
So At the time you were living there and exploring this and watching the matinee serials, was that around the same time the film came out, or was
No,
shortly after that?
it was shortly before
Before.
that, and I lived in Germany. You know, I think I was like 8 years old to 11 years old, something like that. I lived there twice. So I when I was in high school, also spent time on the same military base. But I came back, and then I think probably had maybe 2 years of middle school and high school. And then in 1981, summertime, I remember seeing the film in theaters. Went with my best friend at the time. His name was Kevin Miles. I don't think we've spoken in 40 years, but Kevin, if you happen to hear this, I hope you're doing okay.
Hey, Kevin.
You know, but my best buddy at the time, and yeah, you know, we went and sat down in that darkened theater. You know, experienced an amazing action film, you know, filled with comedy and romance, and you know, you're just drawn into the movie from the
That's it.
very beginning.
Absolutely.
You know, it starts with the Paramount logo and the mountain, and then it dissolves into the actual mountain in Peru. And you know, get your first glimpse of Indiana Jones and just silhouette from behind,
That's it. It's a great
you know,
intro.
with the famous, you know, fedora. And then, you know, for the first couple of minutes as he's, you know, traipsing through the jungle, you know, you get a glimpse of his whip, you know, his gun, you know, his jacket, you know, famous leather jacket, all those sort of iconic things, but he's still a mystery. You know, until one of his sidekicks decides to turn the tables on him and pulls a gun, and then of course you hear the crack of the whip, and he, you know, grabs the gun,
That's
and
it.
the guy runs away. But it's just that whole opening sequence is just
Fantastic.
amazing. You
It
know,
really
Steven
is.
Spielberg at the height of his powers.
Oh, for sure, for sure. And it's such a great way to introduce the character and the first film. And I'm sure in the back of his mind, Spielberg probably had other stories in mind, but he's like, if I only make one Indiana Jones film, I'm going to make the best one I can. And I'm assuming, like most diehard Indiana Jones fans, this is the best in the series. Would you say so?
By leaps and bounds, yes. Not that I don't love the other films in their own way, but I just think Raiders of the Lost Ark is the total package. You know,
Absolutely.
it's in my mind the greatest action movie of all time.
Oh, it really is. It really is. Because he's, like you said, he just continues to fight through grit, through perseverance. He's constantly getting hurt. He's constantly, the odds are always against him, and somehow he pulls through. So he's believable. He's like this guy who's just fumbling through caves, tripping over ropes, and he's like, all right, I'll just get up and keep going because I can't let these precious artifacts fall into the wrong hands. And that's what he's really is all about, is about preserving that history, no matter what it takes. And that makes for such a compelling character. And the reason why there were so many other stories, and the whole Young Indiana Jones series as well, like there's just a wealth of stuff there. We've talked about that in a previous episode, and you kind of answered one of my questions I was going to ask you, is your favorite scene from the film. Would it be the opening, or is there maybe another scene you liked just as much?
It is the opening that, you know, sort of, you know, the quest and all of the booby traps and, you know, the moment when he gets to the idol and he, you know, measures out the
That's right, the
sand
classic
and, you
switch, and
know, and then everything seems great, but all of a sudden that
yeah,
pillar starts to go down and he realizes I need to get the hell out of here. And of
it's
course,
great, isn't it?
the other guide played by Alfred Molina, in one of his very first roles, you know, of course, throw me the whip, throw me the idol.
That's right.
And you know, the guy hightails it out of there. And of course, you know, 20 feet later, we see that, you know, a booby trap has just gone straight through
That's
his
it
head.
again, yeah.
And then, you know, he Indiana Jones gets, you know, to the point where you think, oh, he's going to get out. And then you hear the boulder, you know, that's
Oh, so
coming
good.
down. And ah, yeah. Yeah, it's just an amazing, opening
It
to
really
a
is.
film, and sets up, tells you just about all you need to know about the character, and then, sets up things later, like the snake and the plane, and you hate
That's right.
snakes, and
It
then
introduces the
when,
villain and all of that. Yeah, it's fantastic. It really is. I could just watch
so
the
that's
opening
a,
over and over.
let's do
Yeah, absolutely. The
that.
rest of the film's great as well, but just that opening scene is just,
I would say
you can't fault it.
the other thing that sticks out for me, I mean, oh man, there's just so many great sequences in the film. And in fact, when George Lucas and Steven Spielberg initially came up with the idea, they really structured it around the set pieces that they wanted to do, like the action sequences. And then they brought Lawrence Kasdan in, who's a terrific screenwriter. He wrote Empire Strikes Back, many other great films, to sort of fill in the narrative. But that's one of the things, one of the reasons I think it's so strong as an action film is, it was like Spielberg and George Lucas knew they were going to get this
Oh
opportunity,
yeah.
to go nuts,
Yep, they
and they
did.
just did it. So,
Yeah, they pulled out all the stops. Yeah, you had the
yeah.
director of Jaws who knew how to make a thrill ride movie from start to finish, and you had George Lucas with all his special effects and set piece. It was a perfect
Yeah,
winning
yeah.
combination, you know, and it started this, obviously started this long-term relationship and went from strength to strength, didn't it, with those two. Yeah.
Yeah, so just like fast forward, rewind, stop anywhere, start watching it, and you're going to be entertained. So.
Absolutely. It's a classic film, yeah. And I do have to just ask quickly, your any of the sequels that you like, would you have sort of a ranking, or is it just the first film for you and that's it?
Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, I think, is probably the next one on the list for me. His relationship with his father
It's
and
great,
Sean
isn't it?
Connery's performance, like
Yeah.
it's classic. It's very close, in terms of quality and just
For
my
sure.
appreciation. I really like Dial of Destiny. That was one. I was definitely entertained,
Yeah,
so
wasn't
I
too
think I'd
bad.
probably
Yeah.
rank that third, and then Crystal Skull and Temple of Doom. I don't know. I don't know why Temple of Doom is not higher for me, and maybe I need to go and get back and give it another chance. Not that it's not an entertaining film. It's just kind of lower in terms of the five films.
Yeah, I think it's obviously it's a darker, more morbid kind of film, and Indiana Jones is, you see a different side to him in this film. But yeah, like it, I guess each have their own sort of unique flavor and everything. And we've had The Last Crusade on the podcast, episode 25 with Todd, and now we've got Raiders of the Lost Ark. So, you know, any other guests out there who want to talk about those films, let me know and we can we can complete the saga. But yeah, fantastic. Obviously, I think we could go on about Indiana Jones all day, but we've got two more films that I know you're really keen to talk about. So we might jump to the next film if that's all right, Rob.
Yeah,
And this is
sounds
now the
good.
film that changed your perspective on comedy. Now, this category is it's films that are profound to the viewer personally. They change them in some aspect. In some cases, it changes their life. It changes their understanding of people or a time in history or a certain issue. But for you, this has changed your perspective on comedy because let's face it, this is one of the all-time classic comedies, and it was groundbreaking for its time. And yeah, I'll let you tell us what this film is and why did it change your perspective on comedy?
Yeah, so the film is Mel Brooks' Blazing Saddles.
I'm laughing already.
So just sign
this,
this.
Right here.
Okay, give us a hand here.
All right, sir.
Work, 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 work.
Okay, folks, let's wipe them out!
The heroic sheriff rallies his citizens in the wildest finish the West has ever seen, or the movies have ever shown.
Ow! Oh! Ow! Have you ever seen such cruelty?
It feels like a goofy thing to say, when you talk about, how it changed you, like Blazing Saddles.
Sure.
Come on, what
No,
is that all about?
absolutely. It's a classic. It's a comedy masterpiece in every way. So yeah.
Yeah, it really is. And I say that it changed my perspective on comedy. Maybe it's more accurate to say it gave me a perspective on comedy. Again, this is, at a very young age, but before I moved to Germany, my dad was working for the government. I think I was would be 7 or 8 years old, and we had to move out of our house, prior to making the trip to Germany. And so I lived in a hotel, probably for a month and a half, 2 months, something like that. And this was at the time when, there wasn't cable TV. You had an antenna and maybe two stations, but hotels would have a closed circuit, a way to show a film, in a hotel room. And the film that happened to be the film that was playing when I was living in this hotel for weeks on end was Blazing Saddles. And so my little sister and I, who was probably 3 years old at the time, we watched that movie over and over and over again. And I'm sure that the major appeal of the film was the campfire scene where the cowboys are farting because they've eaten beans. But we watched it over and over and over again.
It's still funny
And
after all these years. It never gets unfunny, that scene, I reckon.
no, it's terrific. And in my film, The Legend of El Chupacabra, there's a scene where one of the characters has some gastrointestinal distress, I guess is how I would describe it. But that is my homage to the scene in Blazing Saddles. And
That
so,
was kind of what I picked up on when I was watching. I'm like, hang on.
yes.
I see the reference now.
Yeah, there are a few other nods to Mel Brooks and his style of comedy, but yeah, we watched it over and over. I think that it sort of helped to build my sense of what comedy is and how to make people laugh. I to this day, any sort of warped comedy, I am on board 100%. I just, really like, everything from Monty Python, early Woody Allen films, the Airplane movies, the Farrelly Brothers, they're all influenced, by the same things that I am influenced by.
That's it.
But yeah, that's definitely the style of comedy that I enjoy, and I attribute that to seeing Blazing Saddles 100 times as a 7-year-old.
It kind of really started a lot of that, didn't it? And I think, yeah, the comedy, like you mentioned, the comedy of Mel Brooks and Monty Python and all those other guys, they sort of take the serious of life and find the funny side to it. You know, like if you look at all their films, it's about all these things we can relate to, or a moment in history, like the Monty Python stuff, and find, well, where's the humor in this? Because we can't take ourselves too seriously in life, right? We've got to be able to laugh at ourselves, I think, and laugh at what our flaws and our faults. And obviously this film, has ch takes a lot of, I guess, controversial topics and makes them funny. Like the fact that it focuses on a man who's a sheriff, who's a black man at a time where it was like, what's going on here? And the scene where he rocks up into town on the horse with that big smile and he's just like tipping his hat to everybody and they're all just like, like they've seen a ghost, and the guy up on the roof who's yelling out, it's a, and then the bells are ringing, and you know what he's saying and what they're covering up. And it's like, wow, like talking about films today and the, you know, the sensitivity and conservatism of viewers today would be like, oh, no, you can't say that. But back in those days, it was like anything was on the table, right? It has no shame, does it?
Yeah. You know, I guess Blazing Saddles is a satire of Westerns, right? Yeah. Like nobody had ever done a satire of Western. I think, you know, Mel Brooks was making a point sort of about the whitewashing, you know, that happens, happened in Western film, right? And that's, right. You know, kind of the tradition. And he wrote the film with Richard Pryor. And so, you know, I think Richard Pryor was, you know, trying to make a point as well, right? Mm. But these characters, like when I watched the movie, it was almost unsettling. I watched it recently because I knew we were coming on the podcast, and I was just like, oh, wow, you know, we are hearing the N-word a lot here, you know?
Very brave.
And I was really trying to, wrap my head around how I, you know, felt about that, right? Because it is, you know, disturbing to hear that word, you know, in the wrong context. But
absolutely,
you know, I think at the time, the film was controversial because of that. You know, it certainly was a different time. But you know, for people who would say, you know, oh, you'd be canceled, you know, if you make that film today. You know, there's a lot of movies out there that use that word, right?
Yeah.
And are working, you know, less hard to make a point about society.
Yeah.
Than Mel Brooks was at the time. So
I think so.
I don't want to get too hung up on that, but you know, I think, you know, if you go and you watch that movie, like, you know, understand that it's satire.
Mm-hmm.
That it is of its time, and at this point, that's what, nearly 50 years old. You know,
point. 74. Yeah, 50 years old. Yeah,
and. You know, just despite that, it's still a hilarious movie.
It is. It really is. And the Mel Brooks brand of comedy is quite unique. And any of these other films that sort of you want to give a mention to that you enjoy?
Of Mel Brooks's movies?
Yeah.
Young Frankenstein, yep. I really think is his best movie.
Yep.
Yeah, that is, you know, just another terrific satire of monster films.
Yep.
It just has so many memorable lines. Mm-hmm. And I think is just absolutely hilarious.
Yep.
Another great performance by Gene Wilder.
Yeah, he was great.
Madeline Kahn. And yeah, so that's one that I would definitely recommend. And History of the World. Part one is another terrific film. So I think for Mel Brooks, those would be my top three.
Wow. Yeah. Cool. And I guess I was introduced to him in the 90s with Robin Hood, Men in Tights, if you remember that one.
Yeah.
Because
it's funny.
Yeah.
Spaceballs is a great
Spaceballs movie, is not too bad. Yeah.
Movie too.
Very silly slapstick kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Not my top three, but it's still a good one.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and then there was another one he did in the 90s with Leslie Nielsen, Dracula, Dead and Loving It, which was a bit of a flop. But I guess I was introduced to him through Robin Hood, Men in Tights. And then I asked my dad, you know, what other movies has this guy made? And that's when I went back and watched Blazing Saddles for the first time. And I think I was about 12 when I first watched it. And it was just on TV like that week, coincidentally. And obviously the scene when they're all sitting around the campfire scoffing down the beans, and the first one burps and you're like, okay, it's a burp. And then one of them farts, and then the next one farts, and this goes on for like a good minute, and it's like a choir, you know, they're all just one after the other. And I remember watching that scene, and I was literally on the floor laughing. And then my dad walks into the lounge room and sees what scene I'm watching, and he has a laugh. And I'm like, it's just comedy gold. It really is.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
So funny. Yeah. So Blazing Saddles, you know, a landmark comedy film, still funny today after all these years. definitely worth a watch, I guess, for people who are interested to see how, these older comedy films and filmmakers sort of have influenced other comedy films over the years. It's an interesting kind of retrospect, and yeah, it's you'll just laugh. It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. So yeah, thanks for bringing it to the podcast. It's a
Yeah, you bet.
we don't have a lot of comedies on our podcast, but we're getting there. We're starting to stack them up.
All right.
But finally, Rob, we've got one more film to chat about, which is the film that you think everyone should see. A comedy of sorts, but in a league very much all of its own, because of its, I guess, its very well-known famous directors who just make whatever the hell they want to make. And yeah, this is a perfect example of some of their early work. So yeah, please tell us, what is this film that everybody should see?
This is the Coen Brothers' Raising Arizona.
Give me that baby, you warthog from hell!
And you want to know another thing? I'm going to be a better person from here on out. Let's go get Nathan Jr.
Raising Arizona, a comedy beyond belief.
Well, it ain't Ozzie and Harriet.
Fantastic. Starring a young Nicolas Cage and Holly Hunter. I think it was one of her first roles, I believe, because she'd come from like a stage
Yeah.
background. And a few other, Coen Brother regulars who pop up, like John Goodman and, a couple of other guys. So Raising Arizona, interesting title for anyone who's not heard anything about this film, even though it's got a bit of a cult status. It's it has a very kind of a unique sort of flavor to it, and it's not for everyone, for sure. But yeah, I mean, tell us, what is Raising Arizona all about?
Yeah, so Raising Arizona is about a career criminal, petty thief, I guess. Generally, somebody who robs convenience stores. Character played by Nicolas Cage. He repeatedly gets thrown into to county jail, and the woman who is who is taking his mugshot is Edwina, I think. I hope I have that right.
That's right.
Played by Holly Hunter, and so he develops a relationship with this woman in a really sort of entertaining sequence where he just continuously commits a crime and is brought back and has his mugshot taken by Holly Hunter's character. They eventually get together. And for a short period of time, are in wedded bliss when she decides that she would like to have a baby, but unfortunately finds out later that she is barren, and so she convinces H.I. McDonough, Nicolas Cage's character, to kidnap a child from a wealthy family who just had quadruplets. And by their reasoning, they have more babies than they need. So what is the harm in kidnapping this child
Yeah,
and
sure. They've got four more.
raising it as their own? Of course, that's not how the parents see the situation, and they send some rather nasty characters to try to reclaim the baby, and hilarity ensues.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And the Coen brothers have done a handful of comedy films over the years, and they're all about real oddball characters and sort of ridiculous situations that probably stretch, reality a little bit, but they're still kind of rooted in some kind of reality, right? So it's a real, yeah, kind of off the wall kind of film, and I loved it. I've haven't there's the first of the Coen brothers comedy movies I've watched more of their dramatic stuff, like Fargo and No Country for Old Men and those kind of things. So yeah, really good, and a good film to start with and kind of work your way up, because all of their films are just really, really re unique, and they somehow find a way to get these characters that are wrong and are doing the wrong thing, but still you like these characters and you root for them. And the thing is that they're a couple that have kidnapped another couple's baby. Like, it's a pretty terrible thing that they do, and one of them is a police officer, right? But still, you kind of want them to become parents and all that. So I guess Yeah, what is it about these characters that just makes us love them so much despite what they've done, in your eyes? What makes them so
Yeah,
likable?
I think it's a it's a great point that you make that the characters are sort of outlandish, but have very human instincts, and I think we can all relate to wanting to be a parent. Not that everybody does have that aspiration, but we understand that. There were things in the film that I think are really relatable. One of the scenes are sort of storylines that plays through the film is that Nicolas Cage's character has two buddies who escape from jail, right?
That's right.
John Goodman being one of them, and they just show up on his doorstep uninvited. And so he's in this very awkward position of wanting to, be cool with his prison buddies,
Of course,
right? And sort of please them and look like the man of the house. But Ed, his wife, is just pissed off, doesn't want him there, doesn't want to have anything to do with them, and just knows that they're trouble, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And I think we've all been in those, sort of similar situations, right? Where you've
For
got
sure.
somebody, who maybe is a house guest and, you just don't want him there,
No, but
but you want to do
you
the
feel like
right
a
thing by
loyalty
your
to them
buddy.
and
And
all of that. Yeah, he definitely feels this loyalty
yeah,
to them.
so that was one of the things that struck me, and I feel like one of the reasons I chose the movie as hey, this is something that everybody should see is because I do think there's a lot of appreciation for the Coen brothers, and we sort of understand their genius as filmmakers. But The Big Lebowski, I think, is one of the movies, like, that's the one that everybody thinks about.
Of course, yeah.
Fargo. Which, Fargo's a brilliant film, and if I had to rate Coen Brothers films, Fargo, would probably be at
Oh yeah,
the
it's
top of
fantastic.
my list. But I feel like Raising Arizona is sort of a hidden gem.
Absolutely.
Not everybody knows about it, and if you love the Coen Brothers, you can really see them, starting to hit their stride as filmmakers, and just in the way that the story is told and the way that it's edited, the camera work, like you can see them, starting to really mature into the filmmakers that, will go on and just do whatever they want to do in whatever
Absolutely.
genre,
Yeah.
and knock it out of the park.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, eventually they got the recognition they deserved when they won Best Film and Best Directors for No Country for Old Men. And quite often, I like to watch clips from the Oscars and I watch the acceptance speeches of all the, best directors and over the years. And when they won it, one of the Coen brothers said, "Thank you for letting us play in our corner of the sandbox." And that always stuck out for me. It's like, yeah, I guess Hollywood is a sandbox. You've got all these big kids in there with different ideas and playing with different toys. Michael Bay does explosions. James Cameron does groundbreaking CGI. And then you've got the Coen brothers making these character-driven things unlike anything else that anyone else can do. And yeah, they're just off in their little corner. And I thought that's just a great way to express that there is room in the sandbox for everybody. And then, we'll stay on our side, you stay on your side. We're both going to create something, but we can share this space and we can do it together. And there's room to kind of embrace different styles of filmmaking. And I think it was really good that the Academy acknowledged that film, as dark and as disturbing and violent as it is. It definitely was the film that deserved to win Best Picture, in my opinion. And the fact that they can direct a film like that with one of the most chilling villains of all time, played by Javier Bardem, they can make these movies like Raising Arizona, which was hilarious, and I really loved the character. I think it was the was he like that drifter, that bounty hunter who's just constantly riding that motorbike and just shows up? Like,
Yeah,
what were
the
your thoughts on this
biker.
guy? Like, I was watching this, I'm like, this guy needs his own movie, but he was fascinating character. What did you think of him?
Well, I loved the sort of the B story, right? Like, he's just constantly moving forward, right? And we only see him in little glimpses, you know, throughout the film, but we know that things are going to come to a head at some point, right?
Yep.
And like, he's going to catch up with this couple that has kidnapped this baby. And that sort of makes it, you know, all the more menacing, you know, just because we're really only seeing him. It's very visual, but he's, you know, a very imposing character. And and so, you know, it's funny in Chupacabra, I actually had a very similar sort of storyline. I had a character called the Man in Black, and he was, you know, pursuing one of the characters throughout the film. And in the end, I cut all of it out just to tighten up the film, because it was initially, the first cut of it was like 2 hours long. And I was just like, that's too long for a comedy. I've got to pare this down. And that was the one thing, because it was really played for a laugh at the end, and it wasn't integral to the story. But anyway, I'm just making that connection now that I probably was influenced, you know, by that. And I know that the characters in Chupacabra also are sort of, you know, this, you know, heightened, you know, characters, you know, one of the main characters is just an absolute buffoon, but they all are also sort of grounded in reality, right? And have real desires and meaningful relationships. And so I think that's probably, you know, some influence from the Coen brothers for
absolutely. Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. And they are such influential filmmakers, because, you know, they take these really interesting characters in these unbelievable situations. And they're all, like, in a lot of ways, they're all very simple characters. If you look at, you know, the dude from Big Lebowski and Nicolas Cage's character from Raising Arizona, and all of the characters in Burn After Reading, you know, they're all just really simple, pretty, you know, stupid people, really. But find themselves in these, like,
a lot of dimwits and
a lot of dimwits, films, you know, and they get you to sympathize with these dimwits. I think it's great, you know, and it you enjoy yourself, and just the energy of the film and the style in which it's made, it doesn't really let up. And I know I really love the scene where he goes to get the diapers and decides he's gonna rob the bank again, rob the convenience store, and this chase ensues through town. You know the one I'm talking about with the famous and everyone's just shooting at him. Like, do you have a favorite scene from the film? would it be that one or a different scene? Or,
boy, that's a good one. When he actually goes to kidnap the baby, and the baby escapes, and you know, there's sort of the tension of him, you know, potentially being caught, but you know, he's just a boob, right? You know, not very smart and not particularly capable, and so, you know, things don't go well. But for me, I think my favorite part of the film is really the opening, and Nicolas Cage's narration of the film, because he really narrates the entire film, and I'm not often a fan of that, you know. I think it can be a cop out, you know, sometimes, like, you don't have a tight enough story, and so you need a narrator to try to make sense of
exposition.
It was very clearly and very clear and very intentional by the Coen brothers to have him narrate the film. You know, it's almost poetry, the dialogue that is the narration. And, you know, in the opening, when we're introduced to the characters and he keeps, you know, getting arrested and coming back and having his mugshot, you know, turn to the right.
That's right.
That's great. Just great stuff.
It is. It really is. It sets up the story really well and really quickly. And it doesn't really sort of explain the attraction, I guess, between Edwina and H.I. Like, she's a police officer, is like, you know, is she just attracted to the rebels, or, you know, the outlaws, or was there something else there? Because then all of a sudden it's like, they're hitched, you know, and they're inseparable after that. So it was a really interesting relationship, I thought, because they kind of do the reverse. Like, he, you know, by the time they're married and ready to have a kid, he's ready to be clean and have a job and do the right thing after years of being in jail. She's the former cop who's now, like, saying, we're going to steal a baby, right? So they kind of almost switch roles. She becomes the criminal mastermind, and he's just like, "Yes, dear, I'll do whatever you want me to do." Right. So it was a great
That's right.
relationship. I found that really entertaining. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
He wears her down. That
He
was
does. He's
my
got a lot of patience, that
rationale
boy.
for why she ends up with him. Yeah, he was
Absolutely. A lot of
just
patience, for
wasn't gonna
sure.
take no for an answer.
Definitely not. Definitely not. Yeah, it's a great film. I find the Coen brothers is there's nothing like it. So I think I totally recommend this as a film everyone should see as well. So, I think it's a great choice. It had always been on my list to watch for many, many years. And great thing about this podcast is when a guest says, "I want to talk about this movie," I'm like, "Right, no worries, I'll go watch it." So I'm getting to watch all these films with a purpose, and I was laughing out loud quite a few times. I really, really enjoyed it. So between Rob and myself, anyone who's watching or listening, definitely watch it. We strongly recommend it. And that brings us
Yes,
almost
give
to the
Raising
end.
Arizona a chance.
Give it a chance, absolutely, absolutely. And that brings us almost to the end, Rob. But I do have sort of one question. I'd really want to pick your brain on it because you're a filmmaker, and you know a lot about film and the art form and all of that. I like to ask some of my guests this question, like the future of movies. Is there stuff you'd like to see more of get made, less of? What do we need to pay more attention to? So yeah, I guess in your mind, future of movies, how would you like that to be? What would you like to see happen?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So I guess what I might like to see less of is the reliance that big studios have on visual effects. I love superhero movies, and I love, the Marvel cinematic universe, but I do feel like it's become a bit diluted, and I think part of what bugs me about the movies is that it just it feels like somebody is barfing visual effects onto the screen, and nothing is real, and so that's my take. I would like to see kind of less of that. I would like to see more films released in theaters. There actually is interesting that there is a decline in the number of films that are being released into theaters. And there was a time when I think it was like 200 movies a year or something, and now we're down to about 80 movies. I do think there's an opportunity for indie filmmakers in that arena, to maybe get more indie films into theaters, and so hopefully that's something that people like myself who are out there making movies on our own can take advantage of.
For sure.
I fear that the cinemas, the theater may not survive if we aren't supporting those theater owners and getting movies into theaters. So it would be a real shame if we lost that experience. It's a communal experience.
Absolutely.
There's something completely different about sitting in a theater with an audience and experiencing a film, and so it's my hope that there's a resurgence of movies in theaters.
I'm totally with you there, and I really have some of the same concerns and hope to see a resurgence as well. That obviously recent world events locking us down and keeping us out of movie theaters, and just the changes and the trends in movies has questioned, where do cinemas and theaters fit in? And I feel there's a place for them. We just have to kind of reinvent the reason why we go there and revive it, like you said, like a resurgence as well. So I think hopefully they'll be there because yeah, there's nothing better than going to a movie, and I love horror movies as well. Sitting in a theater, in a dark theater, watching a horror movie on a big screen, and on occasion I've gone a few times on a weekday in the middle of the day, and I'm the only one in the cinema, which. It's twofold. It's like, oh, where is everyone? This is a shame. But then again, I'm like, I have this whole theater myself. This is pretty sweet, right? Put my feet up on the chair, take my shoes off. It's fantastic. It's great. So you can't beat it. You can't
Yeah,
beat that experience,
there's definitely something to be said for watching a movie with an audience, and there's also to be said for being the only guy in the theater watching a movie, because
that's right,
then you got it all to yourself.
You do. It's great. Yeah. It's great. And I can dream for a minute, like I'm like George Lucas, and I've got my own theater, and I just watch movies, which I'm sure he has something probably similar to that, you know? Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure.
This has been great, Rob. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast and sharing the story of your filmmaking journey and your movie. And, you know, wishing you all the best for the success of the film and getting it out there. And thank you for, you know, your insights on these three films, which are all classics in their own way. And hopefully people who haven't seen some of the lesser known ones will go and check them out. And it's been a pleasure. So thank you for coming on My Movie Story today.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
Awesome. Okay, thank you. Take care.
Take care, Brian.
See you later. Bye.
Thanks for tuning into My Movie Story. We hope you enjoyed today's episode with our special guest and the movies that we talked about. Don't forget to hit that like button, subscribe to our YouTube channel, and follow us on Spotify or your favorite podcast platform. Your support means a lot to us. You can also stay connected with us on social media for all the latest updates and special content, and you'll find our page on Facebook. Until next time, take care and enjoy the movies. See you on the next episode.